There's been a lot of talk about the pros and cons of the embed program. Filmmaker Deborah Scranton cut the middleman right out of that discussion and went straight to the source, troops on the ground. She supplied the cameras, and they cover the war. Scranton says what's important is giving soldiers and Marines the chance to press their own record button on this war. The resulting film is called The War Tapes. Scranton is the film's director.
It was filmed by the soldiers themselves on the front lines. They mounted the cameras, you know, on the dashboards of the Humvees, on the gun turrets, in other places as well. And it really gives you a view through their eyes as their experience unfolded, what it looked like.
How did you get this set up? How did this film get made?
Based on an earlier film I had made on World War II vets from my small town, the New Hampshire National Guard, Major Greg Heilshorn, who's the public affairs officer for the New Hampshire National Guard, called me with an offer to embed in any of the units that were deploying for OIF-2 in 2004. And my idea, literally, I went to sleep and woke up in the middle of the night with an idea of what if I were to, in effect, virtually embed and to give the soldiers cameras and work with them in a permeable relationship over the internet for the Iraq portion. Because what I really wanted to do was to crawl inside the experience of war, to really understand, you know, what it looked like, smelled like, felt like, to see it through their eyes.
It is a big difference, isn't it? If you were to have gone with a camera and accompanied these guys, what got filmed and what got set probably would have been very different.
Yeah, definitely. I also think that my background in television, I had done a lot of sports work, so I was very comfortable with a multi-camera filming platform. And I think we increased the facets of what you can see by having two cameras in one vehicle, you know, one up on the turret and one down below in the vehicle. Plus, normally when the platforms would go out, when the Humvees would go out, there'd be at least three, if not six, in a convoy. So we could have, you know, at one point we had 21 cameras filming. So there could be out on, you know, on a mission, several cameras filming, which would all give you a different perspective that then could be cut together to give you a fuller view of what that day was like.
How did it get decided who was going to have the cameras?
Well, the caveat for my access was once I picked the unit, which was Charlie Company, 3rd of the 172nd, it's a mountain infantry, it's the only infantry unit in the state of New Hampshire. The caveat for my access was that I had to ask the soldiers to volunteer. So I went down to Fort Dix with my executive producer, Chuck Lacey, and a crew, and I hopped out in front of the unit, the 180 guys, and told them my vision, and I made them a promise. I said that we would tell the story wherever it took us, no matter what. And 10 soldiers stepped forward and volunteered to carry cameras and to work with me.
Did you feel as though everybody understood before they left what it was that you were expecting to get out of this? Did you have a kind of shared vision of what the film was going to be made up of when they came home?
No, because we had no way of knowing, you know, how it would work, what it was going to be like. I mean, when they left, things were pretty quiet. But basically, once they got there, if you go back and look at the headlines, all hell broke loose. I mean, that was the April uprising. That's when they hung those four contractors' bodies off the bridge in Fallujah. You know, the war was back on. And we had no way of knowing when they went over how much, you know, action they would see. And in effect, they had over 225 direct enemy engagements while they were there. They saw a lot of action.
Some of this film is just extraordinary. It's not what you see on the news. In fact, I was a little surprised that the Defense Department stuck to its deal with you because, as you say, things changed once they got over there. And this is, well, not everybody comes off as pristine in the end as maybe they wished they would.
Army truck drivers make 17 grand a year, you know, E5. So they outsource it, privatized, save the Army money, and now we pay KBR 120 grand. Do the same job. KBR annoys me. I don't want to talk politics, but man, they got it good. Take every store in your town and let it all be run by one company. I mean, that's basically what they do. They have their hands in anything you can think of. KBR runs all our chow halls.
Today we're having Middle Eastern Swedish meatballs and Iraqi freedom fries.
Look at all these plates, huh?
To charge the military food, they're going to put out 4,000 plates times $28 a plate. So when people take two, because sometimes we take one and then we'll take one and put it on top to keep it warm, it's $56. KBR just charged the government.
every war has got its own little term to dehumanize the other side. And we had gooks in Vietnam, and this war has Hajis. It becomes almost like a filler, you know. Anybody that's non-American almost becomes a Haji. It originated because a lot of the older men in the Arab culture has been done their pilgrimage to Mecca, so when you come back, you become a Haji. So it's used by Arabs, for Arabs, as a term of respect, but somehow I don't think a U.S. soldier on a patrol is used in that context.
The New Hampshire National Guard was very supportive of the project and were very committed to the soldiers being able to tell the story, because they're the ones who are fighting and dying in our name, to help bridge the disconnect. Because I think one of the biggest issues we're facing right now is this disconnect between someone who knows a soldier and, you know, those who don't. And I think it's very, very important until we start seeing soldiers as our neighbors, as us. You know, it shouldn't be an us and them. It needs to be a we. I mean, back in World War II, there was the home front, there was the war front. You know, people had victory gardens. I mean, you can go for days in this country and not really know that there's a war going on. The most important thing is that, you know, wars are done and fought and won or lost by ordinary people. And it's my greatest hope that the war tapes will help to bridge that disconnect between those who know a soldier and those who don't. I would share just one story with you. When the film premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival, all five soldiers who filmed all year were there for the Q&A after. A woman got up and asked a question, and she said, you know, what can I do, what can we do to help soldiers? And they all had their comments, but Brandon Wilkins, who's a Down East Mainer, a man of few words, you know, very eloquently said, get to know one. And he's right. For me, the most memorable moment came when a soldier came up to me. Because usually at the Q&As, the soldiers who are in the audiences don't normally say anything. They wait until it's all over and they kind of hang back, and then they'll come up to me. And I'm pretty sure that I know that they're the soldiers. And this one guy came up and he stood really close to me and looked down at me, and I saw his eyes fill up. And I was like, it's okay. And he started out with, my gunner was throwing candy. And I knew exactly what he was going to say. And he said, you know, I haven't been able to tell my family yet that we hit and killed a kid. I'm a father. I have kids of my own. I'm afraid they're going to think I'm a monster. And he said, but after seeing your film, I'm going to bring my wife back, and we're going to go see your film, and I'm going to tell her. And it's moments like that, which is why I do what I do.
Deborah Scranton is the director of the documentary film, The War Tapes,